At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Art of Craftsmanship podcast. My name is Dustin O'Hara, and I'm here with my brother and co-host, Devin.
Hello.
And we are joined by our special guest today, Adam Gray from AA Forge.
How you doing?
Good, man. All right, Devin, what do you got for us today?
This was our intro into that world. We came in the tradesman entrance and set up our own gear. We were there at 10, ready to work at 10:30 sharp, expected to have two songs done by 1:30. Then we had an hour break for lunch, which we paid for. We would go around the corner to the Alma Pub in the back of St. John's Wood. We were young, and pubs were still grown-up places, so we'd have a ciggy and look older and order half a pint with a cheese roll. The chat would be about the session. Then it was back to the studio from 2:30 to 5:30. Those were the main sessions, two daytime sessions, in which you were expected to have completed four songs.
Oh, man.
Any guesses who it is?
I'm going to guess... and this is purely because I know you as my brother. That is it a quote from one of the Beatles?
Adam, any guesses? I'll let.
Not to be honest.
Well, Dustin, yes, Dustin, you're right.
All right,
that's an easy one for you. And I guess you're thinking if I'm quoting a band, and it's obviously a British band with the pub
British
stuff.
Band. Yeah. Mm.
I was reading the Beatles anthology came out. The documentary, like In Their Words, really great documentary in the early 90s. And then I got a copy of the book from my friend Guy, and there's all this extra stuff in the book, and I was just reading the beginning of the Beatles, and I like that as a story. That's from Paul McCartney just talking about that was them getting started at EMI. Right. That was them starting a business, getting things worked out and being efficient with their time, but also writing Beatles songs, which are obviously good. Anyone will tell you that. So I just like the early days of that stuff. It seemed it's just a business. We'll get it done, but you can make great stuff. And also the crunch. I think that time crunch, like, hey, you got to do four songs a day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It probably was good for them.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, that quote definitely it rings true for my life right now. I have my family, my wife and daughter who's 11, so, you know, that my family life, mm-hmm. and I'm a teacher. So I'm teaching every day from 9 to 4:30, and then I have the Art of Craftsmanship, you know, the channel that we work on, and then mm-hmm. I have the podcast, and I'm also taking classes at night online classes for my certification for teaching. So right now it's like this crazy, every single minute of almost every day that I have is filled with something. And so like when you're reading that, I'm just like, man, that is like hitting true right now. But I think that also mm-hmm. just speaks to, like, I think our ability to push, and to push yourself to do something which can then push great work out of you as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was thinking Adam, of you as a someone who has a business now and someone who puts out quality work constantly, and obviously you're doing it, I'm sure you have to keep to a schedule and you got to push your stuff you got to go, okay, from this time to this time I'm working no matter what, then I get a little break and then I keep going. I was thinking of you turning what I guess a passion into a business.
It's a constant struggle, especially if you're trying to be creative. It's trying to balance creativity, productivity, trying to balance the quality and the speed, and always trying to battle overhead and pushing to be better and do it faster and more organized. Is always a constant struggle for any small business, especially if it's a craft-based business.
Right.
So yeah, the idea there really strikes home with me. It's always a constant fight and battle to do better, to perfect it, to be more organized, and to always push the boundary on just doing it to a higher level every time.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And you're trying as a creative small business, an artistic small business. It's different than you know we're not just making we're not just making books or something where you just pop them out and it's either good or bad. There's a lot you have to figure out. How much time I want to put in this, is it ever done, and when should I just say, okay, it's done, here it is, this is your final
and when
product.
Is it becoming a more of a money pit than it is anything else sometimes? Unfortunately.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, and that, you know, I think, you know, you saying that it's always a struggle to do better and make it more efficient and you know, cover your overhead. And that it's so true. I mean, from when you start and you're just, you know, doing it as a hobby and kind of pushing out and you're trying to, you know, balance how much money do you want to spend on this hobby before I start taking it seriously? When do I put my other things aside and move into this full time?
You
know, and then once you do it, then it's okay. Now I'm doing it and it's kind of working, but how can I do it a little bit better to be more efficient? So even, I mean, you know, the people at the top are still thinking the same thing. You know, it's like we had Andy Rawls, who's a woodworker and YouTuber, on one of our earlier podcasts, and he's right around the 500,000 subscriber mark. And you know, he had the same worries, the same thoughts that we do at the, you know, 90,000 subscriber mark on YouTube. And it's like it never really ends; it just moves up to the next level.
It just kind of compounds and grows; it never changes really.
Yep. So,
I was going to say, I'm sure your worries, Adam, as like, hey, I want to get out one knife. As now you're up to a level like, hey, I got to get out five knives. It's just as just as stressful.
Yeah.
And it's it gets a little wearing at times. It's nice to get some easy work every now and then.
Yeah, I hear that. And I'll come back to that because I think that's a great topic. And Devin always comes to me. He's like, all right, this week we're going to do it real quick. What can we do that we can shoot in 2 days? I'm like, oh, let's try this. And then it always ends up being more. So I'm gonna introduce our guest today. Adam Gray is a custom knife maker, owner and custom knife maker at AA Forge. And one of the things that always drew me to your work, and I've been following you on Instagram for at least the last 3 or 4 years.
Thank you.
You mentioned this, but I really noticed it, that you kind of balance this this love of tradition and what knives have been and come from a long time, but then also intermix that with modern materials and modern design aesthetic and workflows and processes. One of the things as well is that you have just a really beautiful way of balancing all those things, and that's always stood out to me, and it's inspired a lot of the knives that I have designed and thought about when I kind of pull different ideas. When I'm like, okay, I'm thinking about a new knife, and I'll pull up different things online. I always go to yours as well. So welcome. I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about yourself and like some of the history behind what you've done and where you know, how you grew your business, how you became a knife maker, and where you are now as AA Forge.
Well, what a story to compound or compact in just a couple minutes. Well, quite simply, I grew up, I'm a son of a police officer and history buff, whole nine yards. So I grew up in that life around the tactical world and around being an outdoorsman and black powder shooting and rendezvous and all that stuff. So I've always had a love for this this craft and some of the principles involved in it. And from a fairly young age, I had an interest in making knives. And started kind of piddling with it when I was about 15. Just pretty simple stuff. Literally just took a bunch of rocks, some mud, made a simple little forge, stuck a weed burner in it, and a bar of steel. Nice. So it's very humble to start and learn from there. And always had a love for the history, for historical knives. Started making knives that were kind of the colonial style, mountain man style, however you call it. Mm-hmm. And just learned a little more and a little more, got a little more tools. Got a hold of Wayne Goodard's book, $50 Knife Shop, mm-hmm. and that kind of revolutionized my thinking on it, on how to get set up as a knife maker. And I didn't need all the big fancy tools that I saw everybody have.
Right.
And my dad always told me that. He said, a poor craftsman will blame his tools. Mm-hmm. And to this day, my number one sander I use is a Grizzly 2x72, which most knife makers consider junk for a 2x72 grinder.
Yeah, yeah.
But I love it, and I use it, and it works. Have to fix little things here and there every now and then, but I don't need the $3,000, the $4,000 grinders to do it. And just a principle I try to go by. It's better to have the skill than the tool. Mm. And but started the business in 2009. My brother and I, Aaron. That's where the AA comes from. Everybody always asks. There's no two A's in Adam.
I was going to ask about
and
that.
Adam, my name's Adam Ryan Gray, and there's no two A's. So where's the other A come from? It's my brother. And
when I was in high school and I took a driver's ed class, my class was AA Easy Driving, and they called it AA Easy Driving because AA put them in the front of the phone book. Two A's.
I have been accused of that a few times. I said no, that wasn't even my thought at the time. But yeah, we started together, and we started where I would do one part and he would do another part, and then both of us kind of got to a point where we just didn't feel like we were making a complete knife. One of us doing blades, one of us doing handles and all that. So we decided to split different ways, and he went off and started with his business, Gray Wolf Knives, and I stayed with mine, and just grown from there. So it's been 11 years now. Like you said, I've tried to incorporate some of the historical aspects, things that I love growing up, and just some of the history, I guess you say, of such an ancient tool, to bring it up into the modern world with modern materials, modern styling, because some guys get real dogmatic on you have to do one particular style and nothing else. And I don't personally like that. I like to do a little bit of everything. I like getting into chef's knives and hunting knives and EDCs and Bowies and bushcraft. And bushcraft's kind of been the big one for me. But I believe in being flexible, learning as much as you can there. And it's grown.
Yeah, we have I guess, I don't know if it's a what would you call it? It's not a catchphrase, but it's like on at least on this podcast and our channel, Dustin's always trying new stuff. So we're saying we want to help you get into your next first project. Yeah. So your next like new thing, which is, I think we also talk about a maker switch, right? The first time you probably made that knife, you went, okay, I don't have to go buy them now anymore. This is great. You can make them. It's not a fantasy. It's not some magical thing, or to a degree it's not. I can make this, and look here, this is a great thing I made from mud and from some scrap steel I found.
That's been a big driving force for me. When I first got started, it was only forged. I had to learn over time. It's just time management for forging is not real good if you're trying to turn it into a business. It's a lot of fun. But, I followed like Tim Lively Ty Gu and all the guys doing the needle travel bladesmithing, and it was as few power tools as possible. And you learn from that you don't need the gizmos and gadgets and go down to Walmart or Harbor Freight for every little thing you want. You learn to be a little more self-sufficient, and if something breaks, you can fix it. If you need a tool, you can make it. It's kind of an old principle that's gone away over the years.
I do love that about about smithing and forging. Is that like they're the number one people. If they need, you know, you need a tool, you're going to make it. And that's, I mean, so obviously for that craft, if you're going to, you know, you need a drift or you need, you know, a flatter or a fuller, I mean, that's the point, right? You're there to shape steel. So you shape steel and make it the way you want it. I just recently, I would say within the last 2 years, got into doing some forging and blacksmithing just for fun. And man, it has been so much fun. It's such a fun craft, and it's one of those things that I would have I always loved, even when I was a kid, but I never really had the opportunity, and the opportunity arise not too long ago to just take a kind of cheap class to get into it. And man, it's so much fun. So great.
I still remember the first time I got exposed to blacksmithing itself, and kind of in a roundabout way led to the knife making, is at a pioneer festival, a place called Governor Bev's, which is not too far from here.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a little blacksmith shop, and there was a man there for years and years, and he just did a little blacksmith demonstration. He let me run the bellows one year while he was forging some hooks and things. And
he hooked you.
He hooked me. Oh, yeah.
That's great.
And it was just fascinating to me, the idea of using heat to manipulate steel. Mm-hmm. And now, like I said, I've gotten into, I do stock removal almost principally now.
Right.
Because I try to push into some of the more modern steels. Steels that you really can't practically forge. You can if you want the bragging, right?
Right.
But it's just not practical to forge steels like 3V and different stainless steels. You can do more harm than good if you aren't really, really careful.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, right. I don't do as much forging as I used to, and I love to. But hopefully in the future, I got some ideas.
Yeah, I one of the things that I've seen you do, not as often, but occasionally I'll see like a forged knife or something with forged texture on it, or like a chef's knife or a paring knife, and I'm always like, not necessarily surprised, but I'm like, ooh, I'm intrigued, you know, because there's that little bit. I didn't know the background. I didn't know that you had the smithing background first.
Yeah, that's where I came up with that pattern.
Right.
When I decided to move into stock removal knives as the principal direction of my business.
Yep.
I didn't want to lose that brute to forge finish.
Yeah.
I mean, I was doing brute to forge before it was really honestly popular. I would do them in guys on like blade forums, and even some of the bladesmiths, the guys who forge stuff, would tell me it still looks dirty. Don't leave that forge finish on there. But it gives it character. I love it.
Right.
And so now, obviously, as you've seen, the brute to forge finish on hand forged stuff is just in.
Yeah,
and everybody loves it. So I looked at a way, how could I recreate that on a stock removal knife? And I played and played and played with it. And I come up with a fairly simple thing. It's nothing revolutionary. It's a texturing hammer. It's just the way I do it to try to recreate that brute to forged finish on a stock removal knife. So it doesn't have to be completely polished. It has a blade that just screams to be used as opposed to sat on a shelf. That way the handles are nice and sculpted and beautiful, because that's the contact with your hand, but the blade, which actually does the work, you're not afraid to scratch.
Yeah, man, that's huge. Every time I make a knife, as a user, I'm fine to go dirty it up, but if I make a knife for someone else, so many times they're like, oh, I don't want to do anything, or they'll like put it in their room and never use it. I'm like, that's a tool, use it.
Yeah,
it looks
I tell
so
guys
beautiful.
All the time, when I see a knife, a guy sold it for whatever reason, and I see that it was never used, it hurts a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I put a lot of time and a lot of effort and, I mean, just hundreds of hours of research and testing to make sure that it will work when it needs to.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't get used. It's a tool. That's like when buying a hammer and sitting on the shelf, because it looks good and you don't want to use it. To me, it doesn't make sense.
And your grandson or granddaughter is not going to thank you for keeping it clean. They're going to like it a lot more if it's a little beat up. Like, oh, granddad must have done something here. Let me think. Oh, look at this. You know, it's like an instrument. Every time you get a nick in it, you just go, oh, that's more character. Nothing wrong with that.
It's part of the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of exactly. It's important. I don't understand it, to be honest with you. That's why I'm really loving getting into the chef's knives a little bit here lately. Because I know folks will actually use those.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's 100%
it's something every day.
Purpose built. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
I had a. I was thinking, Adam.
Yeah.
Myself and Dustin, we have two other brothers, so I get the brother thing. Now, when your brother, when the second A moved away and started his own knife company, there's got to be some healthy. I would hope healthy competition back and forth now.
Yes and no. Aaron and I have never really been super competitive with each other.
Really?
Yeah, we kind of push each other, but we don't necessarily compete so much.
Right.
Now, as a young, I'm the oldest of three brothers and a sister.
All right.
He was second under me, and he always wanted to be as good as me on everything. It didn't matter what it was. When he's about 4 years. He's 4 years younger than me, and at one point we are obviously very different in size range and all that stuff. He had to do everything as good as me. But for whatever reason, we've never really had that competitive must beat each other streak in each other. I mean, we're even bad enough. We used to love playing paintball growing up, and we refused to play against each other. We didn't fight each other, and then everybody get mad at us because we worked well with each other, and they say, okay, you two against everybody. All right, time for some fun.
Heck yeah, but, there you go.
So that's there's right there. It's not so much competitive as we push each other.
Yeah. Right.
Doing better. I'm that way now with him because he's now back off doing his own thing. He worked with me a little bit again for the last 2 years until just the beginning of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided to do a little bit different direction with his business. And we kind of got to a point where I couldn't give him necessarily enough work to make it worth his while.
Right, right.
So he's back off doing his again. And he's off into kind of a new direction with stuff. And I'm not trying to beat him or compete with him. But I am kind of every now and then, you're getting this done, you're getting that done, you're pushing a little harder, pushing a little farther, getting improving this, improving that, so on and so forth. So yeah, there's, like I said, not competition, but definitely a lot of pushing.
Yeah, I think there's between me and my brothers, and I'm the youngest. I'm the I guess the opposite side, right? Dustin would be the older one. I'm 5 years behind him,
And then our other two brothers are a year, just a little over a year above me. So Devin's the last. I'm the third.
Okay.
Two older brothers. So on the other end of the spectrum.
We are competitive, but I know once it becomes like your business and there's some like money involved, it's only encouragement. Any of that type of, you're not trying to, you would never try to do anything to hurt your brother.
Of course.
It would all be friendly, helpful competition.
Yeah.
Like, hey man, check out what I did. Isn't this awesome? Can you do this? There's a little bit of that. And we have, I mean, our brothers are doing things and starting YouTube channels, and we just want to help them and bring them up and help get them going.
I say we do a little bit to that level.
Right.
It is. Not so much bragging at each other or anything of that nature. Just like you said, that drive.
Yeah.
Can you do it too?
Yeah. I like how you said that. You know, when you guys would do paintball, like you wouldn't go against each other. And there's some of that kind of brother pride there. We always had, a ton of pride for our family, and to the point where people would be like, "What do you mean? You know, can you do this or you can't do this or why would you know this?" And then we'd go to like startup and they'd be like, "Oh, never mind, we know it's because you're the O'Hara brothers." You know, so it was definitely a point of pride that we were. Yeah, like
unless you got
unit.
A couple of brothers, you just don't understand it.
Yeah.
Especially if you're halfway close in age and you grew up together, and it's just there's a bond there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I have a daughter, and my wife and I were trying to have another child back in 2011, and my wife went through breast cancer and on, so it's not feasible at this point for us to have another child, which is fine. Our daughter is amazing and wonderful, and we love her, but there is something I always thought that like it would be nice to have a couple kids because I always loved that relationship between my brothers. Yeah.
Yeah, it was fun growing up with three other siblings, especially from my brother Aaron and I, because we were 4 years apart. Our mom had some health issues, so she couldn't have kids as close as she wanted.
Right.
And so the other two, our other brother and sister, they're significantly younger than us. So it's kind of like us two and them.
Right.
And even then, it's just nice to have some siblings. And that's what I wanted for our boys. We got three boys, but they're all real close, and already they are stuck together like glue.
That's great.
Yeah. I think that's also a nice thing about, I would say in general terms, boys together.
Yeah.
There's less, any time I've, you know, you talk about sisters, it's usually, there's a little bit more, a little bit of anger, a little bit of cattiness, who knows what it is, but for some reason, the brother thing, you fight and you yell at each other maybe, and you wrestle and scuffle, but.
Well, my boys, I made them toy swords, stuff that they can actually fight with, and they're bleeding. 1 minute, the next minute, they're standing up for each other.
Right, exactly.
So I thought, lightweight PVC with some pipe insulation foam on it. Nice and soft and lightweight. Next thing I know, they're busting each other.
That's
but
awesome,
don't you,
Dad. That's,
but don't you dare cross one, because the other one's standing up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I remember my mom, I didn't understand it till I had kids. But she joked about that, because she'd all these people, "I can't believe you have boys. It must be terrible." Because we're young and we're terrorizing everything, wild, getting into stuff. And then when we all got to our teens, they wished they had the boys. Because like you said, that sister rivalry, and it's the emotions. And my dad would not have handled it very well. It's just, I don't know if I could handle it very well, to be honest with you. Thankful I have
right
boys.
On the edge of it, so we'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a little worried. I have I don't know, we might have more kids, but right now I got my daughter. I'm a little worried when she comes to that teenage age, if there's something I'm angry about, I can't just necessarily bust into her room. Mm-hmm. Be like, hey, what's going on? Because if she's changing or anything, yep. I'm stuck. Like, oh, I'm dead. Yell at me, and then I gotta retreat. And then I've lost any power position I had there.
Yep. It's different with boys. It's, you won't listen. You're right. You lost your door.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I don't care if you're naked. Come out here right now. Mm-hmm. Come here.
Yeah, it's just a different world.
Right. And, it's definitely a different world. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's great. That's so much fun. Yeah, and I just think. My mom always said that the same thing, like, you know, boys are tough, you know, they're rambunctious, but just so mm-hmm. much fun. Like, we just had mm-hmm. so much fun growing up with, you know, the mom and our dad. And I remember when we were kids, you know, we'd be fighting and you'd be angry and we'd go and yell at my mom, you know, to my mom mm-hmm. or dad and try to, like, get them to come in. They'd be like, all right, fine, we're going to lock you all in a room and you could kill each other. Go ahead. You know? Yep. And then you're like, oh, wait. I don't want to kill him. You know, I'm angry, but it's, I love that. You're like, you gave your boy some swords. There you go. Yeah. You really don't like him? Yeah. See what happens.
Well, it was supposed to be for healthy sport, but they're being the usual boy thing and they're trying to one up each other and it escalates very quickly.
So I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking, you said you're influenced by kind of historical stuff, kind of, yes. I guess the mountain man, early America's style thing. Mm-hmm. And are you out in Ohio?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Southwest Ohio.
Right. So you're out there where people were headed out and really, really, doing their thing. We're East Coast, so everything is, we're right outside. Well, we're at Baltimore County. So obviously all this was eventually early wild. Mm-hmm. So your influences, were history or were there movies or books that got you on this blade path?
Well, like I said, my father was a history buff. He grew up wanting to be Daniel Boone, to put it simply. Yeah. I mean, he grew up in that generation. Daniel Boone was on TV and everything else, and he's from Kentucky. My grandparents are from Kentucky. So that's kind of the roots of it. I read a lot of the books on Daniel Boone that he had. I can't remember the titles of them off the top of my head. The Frontiersman, but some of the Frontiersmen around this area. And I guess as far as movies, stuff like Last Mohican, things like that, always intrigued me. I grew up going to the rendezvous and the black powder shoots. The National Muzzle Loading Rifle Association shoot is just an hour and a half away from me in Friendship, Indiana. And so we go out there, and I mean, you can just smell black powder in the air, the gunfire at the gun range, and you go through all the booths and all the handmade tomahawks and knives and clothes and guns and just all that stuff. So at a very, very young age, I was just hooked on it. And so I ended up growing up being a bit of a history buff myself with my dad and reading about the colonial times in America in the 1700s through the French and Indian War, up through the Revolutionary War, up into the 1800s and the War of 1812 and just all that. I was hooked on that for quite some time. And that had a pretty big impact on as far as my knife making career and the direction I started anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I agree 100%, and I think that's something that we all did, you know, growing up, especially as boys. Mm-hmm. And we grew up on a farm, so it was always just like out in the woods, getting, you know, limbs to make bows and mm-hmm. you know, and little pocket knives. We all got pocket knives really pretty early because we had, you know, bales of hay to cut up and do, you know, same here. Horses and stuff.
Yeah, I grew up. We always joke we did grow up in a hole in the woods. In fact, you could only see my parents' house from a satellite image because it's a hole in the middle of the woods. And, every summer doing hay, and we had horses and all that stuff. So, I the same way. I grew up in the woods, out in the country, riding horses. Not so much farming as much as, except for baling hay in the summer. Make a killing through the summer as a teenager. But, around here, it's a lot more populated than you think in Southwest Ohio, especially because it's in Cincinnati, and then you got Dayton up in Montgomery County, just a little bit north of us.
Yep.
And we're kind of in a nice area. It's in between the big cities.
Yeah, right on.
Right.
So I wanted you to talk a little bit about it, and I guess this kind of also goes into, you know, going back into your tradition that, and you mentioned earlier about liking different styles and wanting to do different styles and not mm-hmm. trying to, like, kind of, you know, pigeonhole yourself into one thing.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I noticed that I see that very evidently in your work is in your handle styles, that you do a bunch of different type of handle styles as far as, like, you know, different materials, and then you'll do, you know, antler and mm-hmm. Like, you know, wrapped handles, and they all kind of pull from different traditions. I know that obviously mm-hmm. you know, antler and different, you know, natural materials may be pulled more from the historical Colonia area, and then, you know, wrapping handles and things like that. I've seen definitely you have the kind of the Japanese and Asian influence as well.
Yeah. My wife gets on me all the time. I can't sit still on some of this stuff. I'm always, I got just pages and pages and pages of designs and stuff that may never see the light of day, but I got the designs anyway. Yeah. But yeah, I like a little bit of anything. I don't like, I never wanted to be one of those knife makers that picked the wood lure and did only wood lure styles.
Yep.
Or picked Skaggle and did nothing but Skaggle. I like Skaggle knives, but they're not good for everything. And I like wood lures, but they're not good for everything.
Right.
So I just always thought if I'm going to be a knife maker, I'm going to make something as much variety of jobs that can be done, so on and so forth. And every knife is different. Every task sometimes needs a different knife. You're not going to necessarily want to use a kitchen knife to butcher a deer.
Right.
You're not going to want to necessarily EDC a kitchen knife either. But at the same time, I mean, it also goes to the, I like pushing myself. I like trying to learn something new. I like trying to find something that I don't necessarily know well and learning it.
Right.
So sometimes I'll find something. I love the Japanese style. I grew up in the 90s with the Ninja Turtles and all that. So there's a little bit of that in there as well. So I like the Japanese style. And there's a lot of history to the warrior culture to them and all that that I respect. And thought, well, let's find a way to do it my way. Something a little bit unique. Try to do anyway. That's a big thing, is trying to be unique. And in the world of knives, that's a hard thing to do these days.
Yeah.
Yes, right.
So one thing that's unique is doing kind of a little bit of everything. Because like I said, some guys get kind of dogmatic in things. Mm-hmm. And they won't push the envelope. And I like pushing the envelope as much as I can.
Yeah, I feel like a bored creative person, their quality goes down. I mean, maybe. I'm sure you could continue to keep your quality, but you got to keep yourself interested, right? Because that's, I'm sure when you started, it was what you thought you would want.
Exactly.
So,
and then especially really getting into the craft side of it, if you're not learning and you're not growing, you're dying. At least that's my opinion on it. It's, you've always got to be trying to grow, trying to improve something. I mean, you can get into the I've attained and I've gotten to where I want to get, and then never growing beyond that, and then the whole community just kind of goes past you.
Yeah, absolutely. And
like I said, to me, it just seems like it's more about swimming than floating, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Just trying to get better at it, trying to progress it a little bit. And if you just get into the mundane, this is what we do, this is how we do it, and that's the end of it, it just kind of dies.
Yeah, I was listening to the Knife Talk podcast, which came out, the one that came out, I think, a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, with Aaron Goff, a knife maker, Aaron Goff, and he does one knife, and but he's always pushing himself to try a new technique or push, like, he's just pushing and pushing and pushing, and so he has that same thing, and I would, like, listen to him talk about that, and I was like, oh, that's, it's intriguing, it's interesting to try to take one knife and make it better and better and better, but I'm the same way as you. I like all, like, different style knives, like, bigger knives and smaller knives. I'm definitely more of a utilitarian. I think all of my knives have a utility to them, and I don't push it too far past its utility. Like, it doesn't need to be past a certain size. It doesn't need to be a certain shape. It doesn't have to have flair to it, but it needs to work really well and to its utility, and then the craftsmanship has to be high. That's, like, the one thing that we push on the channel, is that everything that we work on, and like you said earlier about having, you know, you can do stuff with really expensive tools, but it's about what you do as a craftsman and how you push yourself and how you move forward and how you use the tools that you have to show the best of your ability at that time. And that's really something that we try to do. And I see that in your work as well, which is just always super, super inspirational.
Yeah. I hate to say it. I mean, I know of knife makers that use top tier tools and have a name. And when I actually got to see their work in person, I was not as impressed as I thought I would be. Maybe even to the point of being a bit discouraged or disappointed.
Right.
A man who, even excluding the style, if you're going to do one knife, one type of knife, and but always try to strive for better.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, it just gets dead to you, and it starts to show. Your customers will notice it quick.
Then it just becomes the job and not the passion anymore.
There's no more passion than you're better off getting a 9-to-5.
Yeah,
plain
right.
and simple. Because if you don't have passion, you're not working 16-hour days on a regular basis to get better and try to make ends meet at it and so on and so forth and actually do well. You have to have passion for it.
Yep.
Yeah, I agree. As Dustin's making more and more knives, pretty much every time we're done a video for the channel or he's come out with something, he's shown it to me like, I think this might be my best knife. Mm-hmm. It's a constant, like, this is great. It's constantly, everything's getting tighter. Everything just tightens up.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, yeah, that's definitely the way it should be. There will come a point with some things that you kind of get to a point where there can't be a lot of growth in it.
Right.
Some things you can only get so perfect.
Yeah.
But then that's where I go, well, okay, then let's change it up and do something a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm going to learn something new. For example, I'm now kind of getting back in the leather work a little bit. I haven't done it for 8 years, and I was never real good at it, and I've just decided I want to perfect it, and I want to do it well. So I'm getting back in the leather work now, doing some of my sheaths and different things.
That's cool. Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because that's one of the things that you don't show a lot in pictures is sheaths. And I was going to ask about that.
That's because for the last... 8 years or so, I've used sheath makers.
Yep.
Because I wasn't real good at making a sheath. And other than giving a man a folded piece of leather that was stitched and held a knife,
right.
I wanted him to have better than that.
Right.
Because I had told him, I said, you're going to get a knife from a knife maker and a sheath from a sheath maker.
Yeah.
And that was kind of my philosophy with the sheaths. I worked hand-in-hand with a few different guys. Right now, I work a lot with Badger Claw Leatherworks.
Yep.
John at Badger Claw Leatherworks, real good man, does good work. And I know a whole bunch of other leather workers I recommend. There's a couple up in Canada, One Tree Leather and different ones for folks who are in Canada and don't want to send stuff back and forth over the border.
Mm-hmm.
And but I've just kind of got it stuck in my craw lately. I want to get good at doing leather work and have it coming from me once again.
Yeah, I agree. And I have the same mindset. I like the idea of doing it. Being, you know, doing each part of that process. But it's funny. I've told other people over this as well that I really enjoy making knives. Like it's every part of it. I love it. I'm having fun the whole time. Not so much with leather. You know, I feel like I'm competent with leather work, and I can do work, and I will do it because I think it's important. Mm-hmm. On my end to have that part, you know, of the thing that I'll make that I give to somebody, but it's, you know, I'm not necessarily enjoying it. You know, it's very,
you're starting to sound like me when I started. It's kind of a necessary evil.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. And it's very like process oriented. It's, there's not a ton of additional art and craft in it. And I think that's what, to me, it's like, okay, it's just the end product, right? At the end, like you said, it's a folded piece of leather that's stitched together. And I take pride in making sure that it's as good as I can make it. It's the craftsmanship is good. All the lines line up, the stitching is clean, you know, everything's burnished and clean, but I don't enjoy it as much. So it's not something it's not like I look forward to it. You know?
Yeah. Well, I understand that.
We were comparing it. I guess it was like, not only were we saying this is kind of a craft thing, like you do arts and crafts almost, because you get out like your little craft kit and you can do X-Acto knives or something bigger than that, but it's a baking situation instead of a cooking situation.
Yeah.
You have to have your steps, your exacting steps. I need to measure this out here. I got to have a 1 cup of this, right? I got to put these exactly here. And if you don't do those steps right, your bread's not going to come out. Your bake's not going to be right. It's not like, I mean, knife making and other things like that, axes and getting the bows right that we do. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of room. You know, you're sanding, you're working it, and you're trying stuff out. You're throwing in spices, but I feel like a nice sheath is you're baking.
That's like a baking.
Some of the stuff I do with my knives, I feel like it's the same thing sometimes though.
Right.
Yeah. Because I have I do some things ways that other men don't.
Right.
And sometimes it creates a process that, trying to use an example. Like, for example, you'll find very common in the knife world, guys will use super glue to glue together liners and the spacers and mm-hmm. different components to a knife handle, mm-hmm. just to layer them up and get scales ready. I won't do that. I refuse to use super glue for anything structural on a knife.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I see that. When I see that, I'm like, really? Super glue?
And it's from some big name makers. Yeah. I don't want to name anybody.
I agree. Yep.
But I know customers who have completely switched to my knives because of this. They've had multiple knives from some of these guys that have actually come up. The liners and the scales are coming apart. Not coming off the knife, but they're delaminating themselves. Yeah. And I understand with natural woods and things can happen, obviously.
Right.
But some of it is entirely because they want to be able to put a little glue on it. In 20 minutes, they're starting to assemble. I use G-Flex for every mm-hmm. component. It's an incredibly strong aeromarine epoxy.
Yep.
But it means I have to wait 7 to 10 hours after layering the scales before I can put them on the knife. Mm. And then it's 7 to 10 hours after they're on the knife before I start shaping the handle. Preferably more. So it's one of those things that if you want to do it fast, you want to do it right.
Right. Yeah, and so that has that feeling of that process, right? You know, you mm-hmm. but I think again there's, you know, it goes back to there is some you're making creative choices on, you know, what things to put together,
yeah.
how to, you know, then obviously once it's all together, then how to shape it, and you know, how are you going to do a Coke bottle, or are you going to do a straight handle, is it, you know, is it going to be a drop point, or is it going to have a clip point?
Yeah.
So there's so much variation and creativity in
what
you can
what you
do. But then, obviously, of course, all of it is process. And especially when mm-hmm. I think when you get to your level and you're doing multiple knives, it just makes sense, efficiency of time, to be able to, you know, grind all your blades and then heat treat all your blades and glue up all your handle scales. You know, you have your processes to be efficient.
Yeah.
With
when you get to the point of doing it as a living, like I have been for the last 7 years now.
Nice.
I can't believe it's been 7 years already. It's coming up on 8 years, actually.
Wow.
But yeah, you've got to have processes down. You've got to be organized.
Yeah.
I kind of miss the days of just freelancing, doing what I want. But you've got to do things in order, or you end up finding yourself at the end of the week with no money. Unfortunately,
right.
There's got to be some organization. This has to be done this day. This has to be done this day. This is going to take so long. While I have this appointment or whatever I have to take care of, so I got to work it around that. And yeah, I mean, sometimes the work schedule goes to midnight. Unfortunately,
yep.
But it's got to be done on that said day. Otherwise, it's going to ruin the rest of the week. And as an example, I mean, I had a tool breakdown on me yesterday and spent 2.5 hours rewiring it, which pushed work a little late, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But it had to be done or today would have been ruined.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Dustin will do the same thing. I shoot and edit all the videos that we make, and the glue part, you have to do it right, but mm-hmm. it's a pain in the butt for for video
yep.
making, because we're like, oh, I guess we're done for now.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be like, hey, how long does it have to sit up? He's like, probably overnight. Like, oh, okay,
yeah,
like, we're done. Wrap it up. I'll see you tomorrow in a few days.
Yeah, that is a nice thing though. If you can stage it right when you're doing multiples, you then move on to a different project.
Yeah.
Mm. And sometimes if you can get creative and work things together, I mean, there'll be, I get all the scales together and I've got them all gluing and curing and now I'm going to grind some more blades mm-hmm. and start on the next batch and things like that.
Right.
And it's just trying to use the time wisely. It's yeah. real easy to sit back with a cup of coffee and say, well, I'm waiting for glue now.
Right.
But,
use that as an excuse. Yeah.
It can be a very easy excuse, unfortunately.
Right.
Adam, I want to ask you...
Yeah.
Do you remember the first knife that you made where you were impressed with your own work?
To be honest, I don't know if I've ever have been impressed with my own work.
Oh, come on, man.
I am. You could ask my wife. I'm not being humble in this. I am my worst critic. I never think I do it good enough. Never think I do it fast enough. And I never think I make my customers happy enough. I'm a pretty bad critic on myself.
Well, that is a good way to keep growing. So let's say, how about this? I'll reframe the question. Do you remember the first knife where you thought, I can sell this?
A couple years ago, maybe. I had one I had done that I really wanted to keep. So I guess I would qualify. I like this enough, I would keep it.
Yeah.
if that makes sense. It's something I was satisfied with enough that it would be what I would make for myself to use. And right. I put up with imperfections that I would never give to a customer. But right. It was one where I would say, this is one I'm happy with it, and I think he'll be satisfied with it to the point that it would be a knife that I would cherish.
Mm. Nice.
And it was actually my Nomad model. And it was just a certain arrangement, the way it worked out. It just came for me, it was just right. But most of the time, I'm really one of those. Like I said, I've been doing this for 16 years now, and I've never been truly satisfied or say proud of anything I've done. Mm. Always trying to impress myself and haven't accomplished it quite yet.
I'm glad you're humble. I'm glad you're pushing it, but I gotta say, I have been inspired by your knives for a long time.
Well, I appreciate that.
Just. And I think it's a combination of, I mean, you know, not necessarily, not that any of this is bad, but not the styles, not the shape of the knife, not the handle, not any one thing, but just there's something about the overall quality and the attention to detail, the quality, the design, all of it. Just they definitely speak to my aesthetic as a knife maker, and so, like I said, I've just. You've been on my Instagram for a long time, and I always appreciate the pictures that pop up. And I actually, one of the knives that I really like your style is the Puko. And I love. I think it might have been one of the first knives that I've seen where you have an even taper from the middle of the handle down to the blade, and then out to the point. But there's an even taper that goes down from the top of the handle and the bottom of the handle and into the blade, and then you have kind of the scoop on the backside, which goes to the back of the knife. And I think that's the first time I really saw that, where the top of the handle had a similar shape to the bottom of the handle. Where you're thinking about that palm swell on the top and the bottom, and that knife, man, that's been a big inspiration for kind of things that I've thought about and planned on and put into my aesthetic since then. It's a great knife.
I did the Puko. The Puko was just starting to catch on all of a sudden, so I thought, well, I want to do a Puko. I have Norwegian blood. I need to have a Scandinavian knife of some sort. So I designed it, but I wanted to do it different. And the palm swell in that is what came to me of it's a guardless knife, and that usually scares everybody to death. With a little bit of basic knife handling skill, it's plenty safe, but I wanted to make it in a way that would really lock your hand in without a guard, and that's where the palm swell and the swoop on the back all came from. That point, for lack of a better term, it's not really a point, but it's more of an apex on the palm swell. Hits. I wear a large glove, large to medium depending on the brand, and that hits right between my ring finger and my middle finger. The idea is that it hooks your hand in, but instead of having your hand butt against something, it hooks your hand in the back, or in the grip itself, so that even if you're working with the tip, you can't slide onto the blade.
Right. Yeah, it's a beautiful design, and I think, again, it kind of relates back to the tradition of Pukos and having that, the transition directly from the blade, from the handle into the blade without a guard. And I agree, there's something really beautiful about that. There's something really simple about the design, and I always go back to the fact that I love simple designs that do the right thing and that aren't super fancy. I've made a bunch of different designs, but that's for my own design that I kind of came up with and made a prototype on the channel, The Journey. That knife specifically has that as well, where there's an even taper, kind of from where the actual back of the handle swoops up and the bottom of the handle is relatively flat.
I don't remember which video it was or which project. I remember you did a basically a Puko, and you had done it with the facets on the handle.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Kind of the octagonal shape.
Yep, that's The Journey. Yeah.
Yeah, I liked that one because I love faceted handles. Yeah. I'm trying to win some of the Bushcraft crowd over to it, but they aren't having it yet. But I love a faceted handle because it gives you such reference for the edge. And if you do it right, you won't get a hot spot.
Right. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I made it that way is the same thing. I really like the idea of a faceted handle. It feels really nice in the hand, but I made the the prototype with the intent to use it, which I've been doing all this summer to kind of feel how it would feel. And I ended up tapering from, you know, the bolster end and the end of the handle up to the middle on both sides, as well as the facets around. So it's still faceted, but it also tapers front to back. So it does fill out a little bit more in the middle of your hand, which I think is important, and it feels a little better. But that's one of those things where I wanted to play with that design and live with it for a while before I put it out, you know, with the intent to like make a small batch run and try to sell some this winter or, you know, into the spring.
Well, I say you go for it.
Yeah.
I like it. I liked how it turned out.
Nice. Thank you. I'm honored.
I'm a knife nut, so I can't help it. And then it just, you did it right, in my opinion. I like faceted handles. I like Pucos. And I think it was a good blend.
Nice. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Def.
I was going to say, the great thing about not just a straight wooden handle is that anyone will be, even if they're not into knives, they can see that it's different right away. Right? You have the resin and all types of interesting looks to it.
Yeah,
it takes some work, and maybe some people might poo-poo, you know, resin or something that's not just wood. But it's a great thing that everyone can immediately see that it's interesting or that it has some value, I think. And there's nothing wrong with that, because I was showing my wife some of your knives, and she liked them. You know, she's not necessarily into knives and whatnot, but she, that looks great. That's cool. That's really nice. Anyone can be into it. You don't have to find a knife freak to be into the style of thing you're putting out.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the multi-pieced handles. A lot of work, especially laying them out, getting everything flush and fit just right. I spent a lot of time at a disc sander with a 90-degree plate, making sure it's squared and flushed and fit just so to make sure that everything's going to be right. And but I think the end result is worth it. I didn't realize, I guess, what I was doing until after a blade show of last year. And I had a whole bunch of knife makers tell me that it was my fault that they had to start doing more complicated handles.
I went, nice.
It's a little old me, and now you're doing it because of that. But yeah, I was kind of shocked that I apparently had a little bit of an impact on the knife world, which is, I guess, saying something.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
So yeah, it does. It's a little more eye-catching, and I like the idea of a, kind of goes back to what we were talking about before. Bolsters on knives are nothing new.
Right.
But how can we do it different? How can we keep the tradition and make it a little nicer? And that's where I'd come up with that idea of you could do something like a beautiful wood, a burl or something, which is not known for being the most durable and this and that, and then put a little, and then use micarta up front. So the section that locks into the sheath and might get abused by the wood that you're batoning or something is a hard, dense, modern material. While the back half of the handle is your nice, beautiful burl. It doesn't get damaged. Also nice if you do kydex, because kydex tears wood to pieces. So doing the micarta up front and the wood in the back means now you can have a nice wood-handled knife with a kydex sheath, which some people just love.
Yeah. That's, I've been interested in kydex for a while, and obviously I see it all the time, and it does have such a nice ability to kind of snap into your knife, and you know, it really does, it secures it well, waterproof, you know, easy to, relatively easy to make, clean. There's something really beautiful and natural about leather that I love, which is why I keep going back to leather, but I've never heard that about kydex, that it can kind of, you know, can be like a wear on the front of the knife.
Yeah, it's just the density issue is all it is, because you got, kydex is actually quite hard, and it can be rough on a wood handle, not always, it depends on the wood. Something like an ironwood handles it really, really well. A good, dense, stabilized burl will handle it good. But if you use something like maple, walnut, anything of that nature, that you can, even Osage, surprisingly, will get scuffed and pressed in a little bit by kydex. So, sometimes if you have a wood that might be a little questionable on it, it's not a bad idea to have the micarta up front on the knife. And it just kind of, it eliminates that variable entirely of damaging that expensive handle.
Yep. Speaking of that, do you what other materials do you use? Do you use G10, or you stick with micarta normally for animal material? Or? I know you.
Do we have a couple hours to list all the materials I work with?
Yeah, I was gonna say I know you use all sorts of fun stuff.
I work with anything, honestly. Yeah. What I have on the website, if I remember correctly, it's like 40 options.
Oh wow!
At one point, I had 67 options on the website and had to cut it down a little bit.
So you cut down,
and that's just stuff that I buy normally and work with. But I work with practically anything. I've tried stuff from copper, space coral, carbon fiber, to hybrid woods. About any stabilized wood you can think of.
Yeah.
Burlap micartas. I mean, I work with all kinds of stuff. There's been a few things that I bought it thinking this is going to be beautiful. It was a nightmare. Absolute nightmare. And on that word, if anybody ever asks you about, I think it's called space coral carbon fiber. It's a copper carbon fiber mix.
Oh wow!
Avoid it. Okay. Beautiful stuff when it's done, but it ruins even carbide drill bits. Heats up copper heats up so bad under a grinder. So you mine that with a carbon fiber, and it gets hot quick. You're always dunking the knife and keeping it cold, even with a sharp belt. And so, yeah, I do a little bit of everything. In fact, I have a knife that just came in. It's an old knife of mine, and a man bought some stabilized mammoth ivory, and he wants me to put it on it. So we're going to give it a shot.
Nice. Well, that's cool.
Yeah, so I almost never say no to a material.
Right.
I'll try a little bit of everything. I'll tell some folks that it may or may not work because I'm not super experienced with it, but I do a little bit of everything.
Right.
Is there anything that you... maybe you will say no to? Is there anything out there that you stay away from? Or
I don't like carbon fiber. I work with it. I usually make the customer pick the set themselves because there's so many different varieties of it, and so on and so forth, unless they just want plain black carbon fiber. But right. Carbon fiber is usually the one I balk on a little bit because it blunts everything so quickly. It itches real bad. The powder is nasty, to say the least. It just, you get done, you're just itchy and feel chalky and can't wash it out of your hands real well. It's just annoying.
What about, its usefulness? I mean, is it relatively comparative to another material that you found that you would recommend someone else if they want carbon fiber? You're like, oh, well, we could use carbon fiber, we can also use this, it'll work just as well.
Unfortunately, there's nothing quite like carbon fiber. It's very unique. It's closest would be a G10, but G10 is not as light. And it doesn't quite have the same pattern. Some guys want carbon fiber because it has that modern space age look.
Yep.
And that's about it. And there's nothing that really mimics it. So sometimes it's just the cosmetics of it is what they're looking for. From practicality, it's lightweight. And that's about it. Because then the micartas and G10s all do pretty much the same job.
Right. Yeah, one of the other materials that I've seen you use off and on over the years is... like antler or bone. Mm-hmm. And I love the look of that. And I love the combination of using a piece of antler, but then, in like a full tang situation where you're actually working with scales. And I think that it has such a great, that it's a perfect transition, I think, between traditional and modern, because, you know, traditionally it would have been a hidden tang and you would have the entire antler. But I think when you flatten it and you have it as a scale, I think it just looks really beautiful. And I love that about some of those knives that you're made with them without it.
I agree. It's interesting to work with on a full tang. Most of my experience with antler and stag of any sort was with hidden tangs. Mm-hmm. And it was John of Badgicola Leatherworks that really got me working with stag for full tangs. We have a ZDC pattern that we developed together. And he decided he wanted it to be a real traditional old school look to it, so he wanted stag for it. And he actually sources most of the stag for his. But it's an interesting balance because a lot of times they have to come from sticks. Mm-hmm. And the shafts and stuff for the beam pieces on antler. Mm-hmm. And you get stuff that's very domed. Mm-hmm. And they're real thick. And by making them thinner, you make them narrower. And you run into all kinds of problems like that. So it's interesting to work with. But when you can do it, and you do it right, it is real nice.
Yeah, I made a small knife for my daughter for Christmas last year. Mm-hmm. It was actually based off of another knife maker's pattern design, Guy Arter Knives. He has a knife called the Atom, which I thought was really beautiful, and I love his small style, and I kind of based my main design off of that. And I did an acrylic liner, black acrylic liner, with just a deer leg bone that we actually, she and I found when we were out kind of foraging around for materials to make a Thanksgiving centerpiece. And I was just lucky enough to get just enough material out of the side of one of those legs to, because it's domed and there's marrow, and it's trying to pull off just enough to get that. I didn't even need that much. It was a kid's knife, so I'm only thinking, I only needed maybe a little bit over a quarter inch thick and then 3/4 wide. So and even that, it was tough pulling that out.
Yeah, it's tough when you're working with round materials.
Yeah.
One I've been wanting to try that I haven't yet is giraffe bone.
Oh yeah, cool.
Jans has it. They got all kinds of different colors. It's very marbled the way they treat it and they stabilize it and dye it. So it has, say if you pick a blue piece, it'll be an off white with this marbling of blue going through it. And giraffe bone obviously is big enough that you can kind of get around that issue.
Right.
A lot of the scales are like 1/2 inch thick or thicker. But it's just beautiful stuff. I actually saw a couple knives done by Adventure Sworn a while back, and he had used it. I went, man, he beat me to it. But I've been eyeballing it for a while. I just haven't pulled the trigger on it because I have so many other projects going. But working with bone, that's one I want to try.
Yeah, it didn't make your cut list of 40 knife handle materials.
No, it's
not yet.
The problem is I've tried to learn over time to avoid stuff that's kind of sporadic in quantity or quality.
Yep.
I fall in love with some materials, taking orders for it, and then and I couldn't get it anymore.
Yeah.
It's gone. Couldn't find anybody to make it or anything. So I was talking to customers and back and forth and trying to find good substitutes, and it's just never a good situation. I hate that.
Right.
And because they ordered the knife wanting that certain thing, and then trying to offer options at the same time, making sure that they're good, solid, stable, consistent options.
Right.
It's a challenge. Especially in the current world that we're living in.
Right, absolutely. A buddy of mine, Sean Porter, he has a YouTube channel called Crafting a Life I Want. He just started not too long ago. He's just getting started in it. He and I are tag teaming two knives for some friends of ours for their kids.
Yeah.
Kind of based off of the knife that I made for my daughter. And just looking, I kind of used off and on different steels, and he wanted to try 80 CRV2 for these knives. So we were looking, and there were a few different places. Jance was sold out of 80 CRV2, and then some other places. We were able to find some places. If you're trying to buy a small amount, then you're going to get charged 15 or 20 bucks for shipping no matter what. So trying to balance that out, but it's definitely...
If you need small quantities of steel, for oddball stuff like that, Alpha Knife Supply.
Alpha, okay.
Absolutely fantastic. Very high quality on everything. They have their stuff thermal cycled. The annealing process that's done on it means that it's ready to harden. You don't have to worry about normalizing annealing or anything, which is real nice. It's in the oven for the set amount of time, quenched in the oil, done. Okay. And they ship like same day. And I always have the stuff within about 4 days of ordering it. It's fantastic. They charge you exactly what it costs to ship it. The pieces come at like 11 inches long, or 23 inches, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. So they're small pieces. So if you want small projects, you want big projects, they got a little bit of everything. So if you're looking for like 80 CRV2, 1095, 52, 100, 15 and 20, 1084, and you just want a little bit, they're the place to go.
Gotcha. Awesome.
So I've been using them for years, and I've always been happy with their steel. Nice. And Chuck, take good care of you.
Right on. Awesome. Yeah, I just wrote that down because we met together on... was that just last night? Just to kind of come up with some design ideas and just go through, what we wanted to do together and kind of figure out who would do what and, we were looking at a few different places just trying to find, economically, save ourselves some money so we're not... And the other thing is, like, we're both enjoy, we're both hobbyist knife makers, so we're also willing to buy additional steel to fill out what we have in our quantities at our shops, but I appreciate that. One of the things that I wanted to mention is that one of the YouTubers that I like and that I watch pretty regularly is Joe Robinette.
Oh, yeah.
And Joe has had a couple of your knives over the years.
He has.
I've got them on his channel.
I'm sorry?
Is there like a, you guys have a relationship, or is just he's just reached out because he's seen your knives? Or I'm curious about that.
He heard about me. If I remember correctly, first from One Tree Leather, who is a sheath maker up in, he's outside of Vancouver, Canada.
Yep.
and a real nice guy. Aaron is his name. He's really, really nice guy. He's a customer of mine, and he's done leather work for Robinette and had mentioned me to him. And Robinette had actually contacted me about maybe making a knife for him, so on and so forth. And before I actually got to it, because I was so swamped in orders at the time, he went and bought something off my website. And in fact, if you see the minimalist he carries occasionally, he actually just bought that off my website randomly.
That's
great. And not a huge connection or relationship there, just he liked him and bought one. And I had sent him one for testing and playing around with. And he's the type of man, he likes to keep it off camera for a long time before you see it.
Right.
Which I definitely appreciate about him.
Yeah.
And to my understanding, he's been enjoying them.
Yeah. I was, when I'd been kind of following him off, you know, for years, and then following you for years separately. Mm-hmm. And then I heard him, you know, pulled it out one time. I was like, this is knife is from AA Forge. I was like, no mm-hmm. way. That's great. Yeah. I love it. And I was like, that's so cool. Like, what a great connection. I think, you know,
he's a real nice guy. In fact, even back during the lockdown, he made a point to give me a little plug in one of his videos just to try to put his part in and keep my sales up a little bit.
That's great.
Word, you know, with everything going on, the craziness back in March and all that.
Yeah.
And he was kind enough, he just gave me a little plug, and real nice guy.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
I was definitely thankful for that.
You would think with the end of the world coming, people would want more knives now, Adam.
Yes, actually, I was kind of surprised how many more people did want knives, to be honest with you.
Apparently, there's some stuff going on. Who knows?
Yeah, I've had everything from orders from men who said that, well, their fun money had to change accounts to the world is ending. I need a blade.
Yeah,
so
okay.
it's been an interesting year. In fact, it's been, I mean, as a small business owner, every small business, doesn't matter what it is, unless you sell survival supplies specifically, you're a little worried about this year in some way, especially come March. And I have been shocked at how good of a year we've actually had business-wise. I mean, there's always ups and downs month to month and everything else when you're self-employed. You got more expenses one month than you're planning on and all that stuff. But it's actually been a pretty decent year.
Nice.
Yeah, you know, if you're selling car tires, maybe not so good. But when you're selling knives, you're doing all right.
People aren't driving. They're out in the woods.
Yeah, right.
Which is a good thing. Less car accidents, more fun with knives.
Right.
I guess speaking of disasters, we like to have all of our guests tell a good disaster story in their maker background. I guess it's just a fun way to. We're all human. We all mess up. All crazy stuff happens to us all.
Where to start? Well, I will say this for you guys, for anybody out there who listens to this and is making knives and is kind of past the beginner stage and into the intermediate stage, I guess you'd say, you tend to make less catastrophic mistakes. Mm-hmm. Obviously, life happens. We're all human. But you kind of get to the point where you start perfecting things a little bit and so on and so forth and kind of learn a little better. But yeah, definitely learning. There's going to be some catastrophes.
Yeah.
One that has always stuck out in my mind is actually the 10th knife I had forged. And I was using coal at the time. Anybody who has any idea with blacksmithing knows exactly where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
I was using coal to forge at the time, and I got distracted. I don't remember what it was. And I had it in just a little bit too long. And I looked over, and I saw this spark come out of the coal. I went, uh-oh. Jerked it out, and I had half a knife.
Oh, man, I knew that's what you were going to say.
All I saw was half a knife and what looked like a little sparkler. Sparking all over the place and dripping steel. And I learned that day that coal gets a little hotter than I thought it did. And you get some catastrophic stuff like that, or what's kind of it's just as catastrophic, but is kind of overlooked at times, is like if you're doing a kitchen knife. It was one of my early kitchen knives, maybe, I don't know, 6 years ago, and trying to be real careful and grinding it down, getting the edge nice and thin, and all of a sudden, before you know it, color. Burn the temper right out of the blade. I mean, talking about a knife that's almost done, and I've spent 8 hours on this thing or more, just trying to put final touches on the bevel and burn out the heat treat.
Yeah, trying to get the edge geometry thin and
because that's the thing with a kitchen knife. You're trying to get it thin, and you get it thin, it heats quicker. Mm. And that's something, especially early on, you have to learn careful because heat builds really, really fast, and you've got to keep it in the water. And so, and I thought I was, but I, you know, new at it and not knowing much, and Yeah, I burned the temp right out of a kitchen knife I was working. I was really happy with it right up to that moment, and I got a little bit upset. That might be an understatement, but I was a little bit upset.
Still stuck in the wall next to your grinder.
It didn't go through the concrete, actually. Nice. Yeah, it was one of those days. It was, you know, everything was going wrong except for that knife, and then all of a sudden, that knife.
That's killing.
So, yeah.
Just cringing.
There's, like I said, it's just, when you've been doing this long, it's just all endless stories like that.
Yep.
I had one actually not too long ago, come to think of it. Doing a glue up on a custom order, and I've glued up 4,000 or 5,000 knives at this point. I'm not sure exactly the exact number. Mm-hmm. And I'm just doing everything like normal. And brass is one of my favorite pin materials to work with. It's real nice, and it's nice because it has a touch of give too. If your holes are just, I mean, sometimes just the slightest bit off because a drill bit moved in the grain of the wood or something. Mm-hmm. Nice thing about brass, it'll flex, and it kind of slips on through anyway. Well, this day it didn't want to. And I don't like tapping scales on. I just don't do it. I like using a vise, and I slowly press them on. So I'm taking my time. I'm going slow. No chance of anything being shocked or dented or bent or anything of that nature. Just being real careful. And I get done with it, and something doesn't look right. And I flip it around the other side, and I realize instead of the pin taking the path of least resistance through the pre-drilled hole, it went through the wood and essentially nailed the scale to the knife.
Oh, goodness.
I was sitting there looking at it first with the confused, how in the world did this just happen? And then the frustration set in that I had to rip the handle off that I just spent all this time prepping and start all over with glue everywhere and the mess and all that. So yeah, every now and then you just have those days.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why, and what I mentioned to you is that we love to hear disaster stories, and we told our own disaster stories when we were first starting the podcast. It's the reality, you know. We all have those days. Everybody has those things, and like you said, even the longer you do it, they build up. You have more and more of them. Obviously, like you said, you learn. You know, they're smaller, they're less catastrophic over the years, but well, they're there, you know. We all have the reality that people starting off might make it for the first time. You know, you might have something, and don't get discouraged. You know, we all been there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You can't let the little mistakes, even the big ones, to hold you back. It's one of those. Just make it a stepping stone and learn from it.
Yep. I wanted to reference one more knife before we kind of get to the end of the podcast. Just recently, within the last maybe week or two, you posted a post on Instagram. That was titled, or you captioned it as cream cheese stuffed chicken. And on that post, you had this beautiful little paring knife. And I was like, whoo, zoomed in on it. I was like, man, look at this beautiful little knife. Is that one of yours? Is that a newer one, an older one? Or
that is my wife's.
All right.
I made that for her right after we got married, actually. It's actually been about 6 years since I made it for now.
And we just
passed our 6-year anniversary back in October, and it was somewhere like November, December-ish that I made it for. Yeah, it's just a little paring knife, kind of Japanese-ish designed or influenced.
Yep.
01 tool steel, hand sanded. The whole thing's hand sanded to a nice hand rub satin finish. Yep. Brass bolster and a dark roasted curly maple handle. And she's been using it now for 6 years, and it's holding up good.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Does it have a little brass pin running through it as well?
Yeah, one little mosaic pin.
Yep. Yeah, it's just a beautiful little knife. And like I said, I've always been inspired by your knives, but you know, occasionally one will pop up where I look at it like, oh man, look at that.
Yeah.
You still surprise me. You still inspire me. It's beautiful.
Well, she keeps telling me I need to make more of those. I said, by the time I made it, nobody wanted one. Nobody. It's like everybody went, yeah, it's a kitchen knife, and moved on.
Right. Yeah.
And now my wife, she loves to cook, and she's getting involved. She's always helped me with Instagram as far as keeping up with stuff. But then she loves cooking outdoors and everything. So she's trying to help with more posts and more activity on Instagram and throwing the stuff she's cooking. That was one of the meals she came up with last minute last week. And now all of a sudden she's using them and putting them in pictures. People want them.
Yeah, that's great.
I guess I'm gonna make some.
You have to name the line after your wife or just call it the newlywed.
There you go. Yeah, most people, they get a kick out of when she puts stuff up because she's always signed it the wife.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. I saw that, the wife,
Yeah, there are a lot of people who know her name. There are a couple, I guess.
Right. But,
likes it. It's kind of her little inside joke, I guess.
Yeah, I was one of the notes I wrote down was to maybe talk to you about the food you know, posts and stuff mm-hmm. you put up, because I've seen them off and on, you know, more recently, and
yeah.
great. You know, it's just like more outdoor living, and just, you know, it shows again back to just your relationship with working outside, and
yeah,
it does a good job to bring it back to that idea.
Yeah, we're both very outdoorsy. We love being out as much as we can, and she loves to cook over the fire. She yeah. loves cooking outside, so it just works mm. out well. She joked about it, because they did a lot of that growing up, outdoor cooking and so on and so forth, and she said she never would have imagined marrying a knife maker and it just being part of the business. And it's good for advertising, and we enjoy doing it, and as well, we can help our business and have a good meal at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it's worked out well.
That's perfect.
All right, so let's do some recommendations. I'm going to start out. I've been watching, Dustin and I have been talking about upgrading our camera gear. I love the Nikons we have now, mm-hmm. And it's a nice image, but we think it's time to maybe go to 4K and start trying some other things and other avenues where we can, like you say, Adam, continue to bump our quality mm-hmm. up. Even if we're somewhat happy with what we have now, we want to just yeah. keep advancing. So there's this guy, Kai, or K-A-I-W. He jumps between London and Korea, I think. And he's just a great camera reviewer, really funny, yeah. really quality stuff. And pretty much every time I go to look at cameras and camera gear, I go to him. So check him out. Anyone who's looking for either still photography or video or getting into YouTube, yeah. he goes over the stuff really, really well. And he doesn't talk over you. He doesn't yeah. talk down to you. It's a nice right in the middle. He'll give you all the stats that you can understand it in a funny package. So check him out.
I will do.
All right. Adam, you have a recommendation for us?
In the specific subject?
No, I would say just you know, you've actually referenced quite a few different people and books, and maybe yeah. someone who's inspired you over the years, or someone who on Instagram that you want to shout out.
Well, as far as a good recommendation for a book for a new knife maker, I would definitely recommend $50 Knife Shop.
Yeah.
Because it's not so much the projects he does as the mindset he gives you. Because the idea is, for $50, you can make a good knife. Mm. You don't have to have the fancy stuff. And he shows you, he has a lot of improvised tools and hollow grinding jigs and all kinds of things that are really outside the box. And I really enjoyed it when I was a kid and got that book. In fact, I have another copy now. It's a good book for a beginner. And as far as like on Instagram... some knife makers and different ones. I follow so many knife makers because I admire the craft. I drive my wife nuts because if I'm not making knives, I'm watching YouTube videos on knives and all that. I can't help it. I love the craft of it. And I'm trying to think. There are so many knife makers on there that are really, really good. I'm trying to think of somebody in particular stands out. Someone like Ben Orford, for example, is of Orford Knives.
Yep.
He's someone who really, really inspired me on the quality of your work. Yeah. He's got a YouTube channel and an Instagram page, and he's got a way of presenting his videos that he's given you some very complicated crafting techniques, but he makes it seem so simple, mm-hmm. and he just puts it in a way that you can understand it. Mm-hmm. And he even has started some instructional videos for knife making recently, just showing how he does some things. And I can attest, because I have one of his knives, I know him. He's kind of a knife making friend of mine. He's a good man, does good work, and just enjoy following his stuff.
All right, awesome. Nice. What's the author of $50 Knife Shop? Do you know off the top?
Wayne Goddard.
All right. And I will finish up. It's funny, we referenced earlier Brute to Forge, and one of the knife makers that I really enjoy and have kind of followed over the years, and then also really enjoy his YouTube channel, which he started up recently, is Jason Knight. Now, Jason Knight has, you know, he's got some acclaim because he was on Forged in Fire, and he's got his mm-hmm. podcast, and frustratingly, he started a YouTube recently, and then it's mm-hmm. like just growing, his channel's growing super fast, but
he's a very eccentric character.
He is. Yeah, he's got a great personality. But he just posted a new video 2 days ago, which is a knife making $5 to $2,000 junkyard knife. And I watched the first episode. It's just super fun. It's just him kind of walking around in the junkyard, and my wife was like, he sounds like either a surfer or he's kind of high. Like, well, I think that's just the way Jason, like, that's just his person. That's the way he talks. He does kind of have that relaxed, you know, kind of ability to come across. But it's really captivating and fun to see what he's pulling from the junkyard and, you know, antique shops and stuff. And I'm intrigued to see where it's going to go. So that's my recommendation for this week is, Jason Knight on YouTube. And, I will post a link to his video, part one of the junkyard knife.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to how that old butcher knife's getting incorporated.
Yeah, right. Exactly. He's like, this is kind of cool. It's gotta be some type of tool steel.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Adam, thank you so much, man.
I appreciate
this. This has been a pleasure. I love that we got to know you a little bit better. And like I said, you know, you've been an inspiration for me as a knife maker for a long time as well. So it's great to get to chat and hear a little bit about your background.
What's the Instagram name officially? There's a lot of underscores, Adam. What is it?
Instagram forced the underscores. But it's,
yeah, exactly.
I think it's AA_forge_handcrafted knives.
All right.
And what's, I don't remember the exact underscores at the moment, but it's AA Forge Handcrafted Knives.
Yeah, and I'll obviously put a link in the description of the video, the video details, and also if you guys want to find Adam there, definitely find him on Instagram, and then and your website?
AAForge.com. A whole lot simpler than Instagram.
There you go. All right.
But yeah, I definitely appreciate it. I've enjoyed this.
That's great.
That's fun. Fun for
and
sure.
You are super flexible. I know I reached out to you maybe about a month or so ago, and there were a couple times where we almost were able to do it. And, you know, we definitely appreciate it.
Family and kids. And when you're self employed, you learn to roll the punches and work with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there was one a couple weeks ago where Devin had just had a baby, and we were trying to squeeze in one more, or maybe we were trying to squeeze in a podcast right before it, and I was like, why don't we reach out to Adam and see?
I've been there.
It didn't work out, but you know, you're
congratulations,
like, I know,
I've
got three kids, so. All right, everybody. Well, thank you all so much for listening. This has been fun. You guys can find us on Instagram at The Art of Craftsmanship, and you can also find us on YouTube at The Art of Craftsmanship. If you are so inspired and you want to support the channel and the podcast, you guys can also find us on Patreon / The Art of Craftsmanship. We're also on the Makery Network, and there's lots of awesome podcasters on the Makery Network, so we really appreciate everybody listening, and go check those guys out as well, because it's just a great group of people who are inspired by making things and by makers and really want to kind of push that avenue of what we all do. So once again, Adam, thank you so much. Devin, it's always a pleasure to chat with you, my brother, and we will talk to you guys all next time.
If you like this show, take a look at our other shows made for makers just like you at www.makery.network.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate.
but nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.